due selection at the level of embryos or gametes. Pre-implantation genetic diagnosis has already been used during in vitro fertilization procedures to screen embryos produced for monogenic disorders such as Huntington's disease, and for predisposition to some late-onset diseases, such as breast cancer. It has also been used for sex selection, and for matching human leukocyte antigen type with that of a sick sibling, who can then benefit from a cord blood stem cell donation when the new baby is born. The range of traits that can be selected for or against will expand greatly over the next decade or two. A strong driver of progress in behavioral genetics is the rapidly falling cost of genotyping and gene sequencing. Genome-wide complex trait analysis, using studies with vast numbers of subjects, is just now starting to become feasible and will greatly increase our knowledge of the genetic architectures of human cognitive and behavioral traits. Any trait with a non-negligible heritability, including cognitive capacity, could then become susceptible to selection. Embryo selection does not require a deep understanding of the causal pathways by which genes, in complicated interplay with environments, produce phenotypes. It requires only lots of data on the genetic correlates of the traits of interest. It is possible to calculate some rough estimates of the magnitude of the gains obtainable in different selection scenarios. Table 5 shows expected increases in intelligence resulting from various amounts of selection, assuming complete information about the common, additive genetic variants underlying the narrow-sense heritability of intelligence. With partial information, the effectiveness of selection would be reduced, though not quite to the extent one might naively expect. Unsurprisingly, selecting between larger numbers of embryos produces larger gains, but there are steeply diminishing returns. Selection between 100 embryos does not produce a gain anywhere near 50 times as large as that which one would get from selection between 2 embryos. Interestingly, the diminishment of returns is greatly abated when the selection is spread over multiple generations. Thus, repeatedly selecting the top 1 in 10 over 10 generations, where each new generation consists of the offspring of those selected in the previous generation, will produce a much greater increase in the trait value than a one-off selection of 1 in 100. The problem with sequential selection, of course, is that it takes longer. If each generational step takes 20 or 30 years, then even just 5 successive generations would push us well into the 22nd century. Long before then, more direct and powerful modes of genetic engineering, not to mention machine intelligence, will most likely be available. There is, however, a complementary technology, one which, once it has been developed for use in humans, would greatly potentiate the enhancement power of pre-implantation genetic screening, namely, the derivation of viable sperm and eggs from embryonic stem cells. The techniques for this have already been used to produce fertile offspring in mice and gamete-like cells in humans. Substantial scientific challenges remain, however, in translating the animal results to humans and in avoiding epigenetic abnormalities in the derived stem cell lines. According to one expert, these challenges might put human application 10 or even 50 years in the future. With stem cell-derived gametes, the amount of selection power available to a couple could be greatly increased. In current practice, an in vitro fertilization procedure typically involves the creation of fewer than 10 embryos. With stem cell-derived gametes, a few donated cells might be turned into a virtually unlimited number of gametes that could be combined to produce embryos, which could then be genotyped or sequenced, and the most promising one chosen for implantation. Depending on the cost of preparing and screening each individual embryo, this technology could yield a several-fold increase in the selective power available to couples using in vitro fertilization. More importantly still, stem cell-derived gametes would allow multiple generations of selection to be compressed into less than a human maturation period, by enabling Iterated embryo selection. This is a procedure that will consist of the following steps. 1. Genotype and select a number of embryos that are higher in desired genetic characteristics. 2. Extract stem cells from those embryos and convert them to sperm and ova, maturing within 6 months or less. 3. Cross the new sperm and ova to produce embryos. 4. Repeat until large genetic changes have been accumulated. In this manner, it would be possible to accomplish 10 or more generations of selection in just a few years. The procedure would be time-consuming and expensive. However, in principle, it would need to be done only once, rather than repeated for each birth. The cell lines established at the end of the procedure could be used to generate very large numbers of enhanced embryos. As Table 5 indicates, the average level of intelligence among individuals conceived in this manner could be very high, possibly equal to or somewhat above that of the most intelligent individual in the historical human population. A world that had a large population of such individuals might, if it had the culture, education, communications infrastructure, etc. to match, constitute a collective superintelligence. The impact of this technology will be dampened and delayed by several factors. There is the unavoidable maturational lag while the finely selected embryos grow into adult human beings. At least 20 years before an enhanced child reaches full productivity. Longer still, before such children come to constitute a substantial segment of the labor force. Furthermore, even after the technology has been perfected, adoption rates will probably start out low. Some countries might prohibit its use altogether on moral or religious grounds. Even where selection is allowed, many couples will prefer the natural way of conceiving. Willingness to use IVF, however, would increase if there were clearer benefits associated with the procedure, such as a virtual guarantee that the child would be highly talented and free from genetic predispositions to disease. Lower healthcare costs and higher expected lifetime earnings would also argue in favor of genetic selection. As use of the procedure becomes more common, particularly among social elites, there might be a cultural shift toward parenting norms that present the use of selection as the thing that responsible, enlightened couples do. Many of the initially reluctant might join the bandwagon in order to have a child that is not at a disadvantage relative to the enhanced children of their friends and colleagues. Some countries might offer inducements to encourage their citizens to take advantage of genetic selection in order to increase the country's stock of human capital, or to increase long-term social stability by selecting for traits like docility, obedience, submissiveness, conformity, risk aversion, or cowardice outside of the ruling clan. Effects on intellectual capacity would also depend on the extent to which the available selection power would be used for enhancing cognitive traits. Table 6. Those who do opt to use some form of embryo selection would have to choose how to allocate the selection power at their disposal, and intelligence would to some extent be in competition with other desired attributes, such as health, beauty, personality, or athleticism. Iterated embryo selection, by offering such a large amount of selection power, would alleviate some of these trade-offs, enabling simultaneous strong selection for multiple traits. However, this procedure would tend to disrupt the normal genetic relationship between parents and child, something that could negatively affect demand in many cultures. With further advances in genetic technology, it may become possible to synthesize genomes to specification, obviating the need for large pools of embryos. DNA synthesis is already a routine and largely automated biotechnology, though it is not yet feasible to synthesize an entire human genome that could be used in a reproductive context, not least because of still unresolved difficulties in getting the epigenetics right. But once this technology has matured, an embryo could be designed with the exact preferred combination of genetic inputs from each parent. Genes that are present in neither of the parents could also be spliced in, including alleles that are present with low frequency in the population, but which may have significant positive effects on cognition. One intervention that becomes possible when human genomes can be synthesized is genetic spell checking of an embryo. Iterated embryo selection might also allow an approximation of this. Each of us currently carries a mutational load, with perhaps hundreds of mutations that reduce the efficiency of various cellular processes. Each individual mutation has an almost negligible effect, once it is only slowly removed from the gene pool. Yet in combination, such mutations may exact a heavy toll on our functioning. Individual differences in intelligence might to a significant extent be attributable to variations in the number and nature of such slightly deleterious alleles that each of us carries. With gene synthesis, we could take the genome of an embryo and construct a version of that genome free from the genetic noise of accumulated mutations. If one wished to speak provocatively, one could say that individuals created from such proofread genomes might be more human than anybody currently alive, in that they would be less distorted expressions of human form. Such people would not all be carbon copies, because humans vary genetically in ways other than by carrying different deleterious mutations. But the phenotypical manifestation of a proofread genome may be an exceptional physical and mental constitution, with elevated functioning in polygenic trait dimensions like intelligence, health, hardiness, and appearance. A loose analogy could be made with composite faces, in which the defects of the superimposed individuals are averaged out. See Figure 6. Other potential biotechnological techniques might also be relevant. Human reproductive cloning, once achieved, could be used to replicate the genome of exceptionally talented individuals. Uptake would be limited by the preference of most prospective parents to be biologically related to their children. Yet the practice could nevertheless come to have non-negligible impact because, one, even a relatively small increase in the number of exceptionally talented people might have a significant effect, and two, it is possible that some state would embark on a larger-scale eugenics program, perhaps by paying surrogate mothers. Other kinds of genetic engineering, such as the design of novel synthetic genes or insertion into the genome of promoter regions and other elements to control gene expression, might also become important over time. Even more exotic possibilities may exist, such as vats full of complexly structured cultured cortical tissue, or uplifted transgenic animals, perhaps some large-brained mammals such as the whale or elephant, enriched with human genes. These latter ones are wholly speculative, but over a longer time frame, they perhaps cannot be completely discounted. So far, we have discussed germline interventions, ones that would be done on gametes or embryos. Somatic gene enhancements, by bypassing the generation cycle, could in principle produce impacts more quickly. However, they are technologically much more challenging. They require that the modified genes be inserted into a large number of cells in the living body, including, in the case of cognitive enhancement, the brain. Selecting among existing egg cells or embryos, in contrast, requires no gene insertion. Even such germline therapies as do involve modifying the genome, such as proofreading the genome or splicing in rare alleles, are far easier to implement at the gamete or the embryo stage, where one is dealing with a small number of cells. Furthermore, germline interventions on embryos can probably achieve greater effects than somatic interventions on adults, because the former would be able to shape early brain development, whereas the latter would be limited to tweaking an existing structure. Some of what could be done through somatic gene therapy might also be achievable by pharmacological means. Focusing, therefore, on germline interventions, we must take into account the generational lag delaying any large impact on the world. Even if the technology were perfected today and immediately put to use, it would take more than 2 decades for a genetically enhanced brood to reach maturity. Furthermore, with human applications, there is normally a delay of at least 1 decade between proof of concept in the laboratory and clinical application, because of the need for extensive studies to determine safety. The simplest forms of genetic selection, however, could largely abrogate the need for such testing, since they would use standard fertility treatment techniques and genetic information to choose between embryos that might otherwise have been selected by chance. Delays could also result from obstacles rooted not in a fear of failure, demand for safety testing, but in fear of success, demand for regulation driven by concerns about the moral permissibility of genetic selection or its wider social implications. Such concerns are likely to be more influential in some countries than in others, owing to differing cultural, historical, and religious contexts. Post-war Germany, for example, has chosen to give a wide berth to any reproductive practices that could be perceived to be even in the remotest way aimed at enhancement, a stance that is understandable given the particularly dark history of atrocities connected to the eugenics movement in that country. Other Western countries are likely to take a more liberal approach, and some countries, perhaps China or Singapore, both of which have long-term population policies, might not only permit, but actively promote the use of genetic selection and genetic engineering to enhance the intelligence of their populations once the technology to do so is available. Once the example has been set and the results start to show, holdouts will have strong incentives to follow suit. Nations would face the prospect of becoming cognitive backwaters and losing out in economic, scientific, military, and prestige contests with competitors that embrace the new human enhancement technologies. Individuals within a society would see places at elite schools being filled with genetically selected children, who may also on average be prettier, healthier, and more conscientious, and will want their own offspring to have the same advantages. There is some chance that a large attitudinal shift could take place over a relatively short time, perhaps in as little as a decade, once the technology is proven to work and to provide a substantial benefit. Opinion surveys in the United States reveal a dramatic shift in public approval of in vitro fertilization after the birth of the first test tube baby, Louise Brown, in 1978. A few years earlier, only 18% of Americans said they would personally use IVF to treat infertility. Yet in a poll taken shortly after the birth of Louise Brown, 53% said they would do so, and the number has continued to rise. For comparison, in a poll taken in 2004, 28% of Americans approved of embryo selection for strength or intelligence, 58% approved of it for avoiding adult-onset cancer, and 68% approved of it to avoid fatal childhood disease. If we add up the various delays, say 5 to 10 years to gather the information needed for significantly effective selection among a set of IVF embryos, possibly much longer before stem cell-derived gametes are available for use in human reproduction, 10 years to build significant uptake, and 20 to 25 years for the enhanced generation to reach an age where they start becoming productive, we find that germline enhancements are unlikely to have a significant impact on society before the middle of this century. From that point onward, however, the intelligence of significant segments of the adult population may begin to be boosted by genetic enhancements. The speed of the ascent would then greatly accelerate as cohorts conceived using more powerful next-generation genetic technologies, in particular stem cell-derived gametes and iterative embryo selection, enter the labor force. With the full development of the genetic technologies described above, setting aside the more exotic possibilities such as intelligence in cultured neural tissue, it might be possible to ensure that new individuals are on average smarter than any human who has yet existed, with peaks that rise higher still. The potential of biological enhancement is thus ultimately high, probably sufficient for the attainment of at least weak forms of superintelligence, This should not be surprising. After all, dumb evolutionary processes have dramatically amplified the intelligence in the human lineage, even compared with our close relatives, the great apes, and our own humanoid ancestors. And there is no reason to suppose Homo sapiens to have reached the apex of cognitive effectiveness attainable in a biological system. Far from being the smartest possible biological species, we are probably better thought of as the stupidest possible biological species capable of starting a technological civilization. A niche we filled because we got there first, not because we are in any sense optimally adapted to it. Progress along the biological path is clearly feasible. The generational lag in germline interventions means that progress could not be nearly as sudden and abrupt as in scenarios involving machine intelligence. Somatic gene therapies and pharmacological interventions could theoretically skip the generational lag, but they seem harder to perfect and are less likely to produce dramatic effects. The ultimate potential of machine intelligence is, of course, vastly greater than that of organic intelligence. One can get some sense of the magnitude of the gap by considering the speed differential between electronic components and nerve cells. Even today's transistors operate on a timescale 10 million times shorter than that of biological neurons. However, even comparatively moderate enhancements of biological cognition could have important consequences. In particular, cognitive enhancement could accelerate science and technology, including progress toward more potent forms of biological intelligence amplification and machine intelligence. Consider how the rate of progress in the field of artificial intelligence would change in a world where Average Joe is an intellectual peer of Alan Turing or John von Neumann, and where millions of people tower far above any intellectual giant of the past. A discussion of the strategic implications of cognitive enhancement will have to await a later chapter. But we can summarize this section by noting three conclusions. 1. At least weak forms of superintelligence are achievable by means of biotechnological enhancements. 2. The feasibility of cognitively enhanced humans adds to the plausibility that advanced forms of machine intelligence are feasible. Because even if we were fundamentally unable to create machine intelligence, which there is no reason to suppose, machine intelligence might still be within reach of cognitively enhanced humans. And 3. When we consider scenarios stretching significantly into the second half of this century and beyond, we must take into account the probable emergence of a generation of genetically enhanced populations, voters, inventors, scientists, with the magnitude of enhancement escalating rapidly over subsequent decades. Brain-computer interfaces. It is sometimes proposed that direct brain-computer interfaces, particularly implants, could enable humans to exploit the fortes of digital computing, perfect recall, speedy and accurate arithmetic calculation, and high bandwidth data transmission, enabling the resulting hybrid system to radically outperform the unaugmented brain. But although the possibility of direct connections between human brains and computers has been demonstrated, it seems unlikely that such interfaces will be widely used as enhancements anytime soon. To begin with, there are significant risks of medical complications, including infections, electrode displacement, hemorrhage, and cognitive decline when implanting electrodes in the brain. Perhaps the most vivid illustration to date of the benefits that can be obtained through brain stimulation is the treatment of patients with Parkinson's disease. The Parkinson's implant is relatively simple. It does not really communicate with the brain, but simply supplies a stimulating electric current to the subthalamic nucleus. A demonstration video shows a subject slumped in a chair, completely immobilized by the disease, then suddenly springing to life when the current is switched on. The subject now moves his arms, stands up and walks across the room, turns around and performs a pirouette. Yet even behind this especially simple and almost miraculously successful procedure, there lurk negatives, One study of Parkinson patients who had received deep brain implants showed reductions in verbal fluency, selective attention, color naming, and verbal memory compared with controls. Treated subjects also reported more cognitive complaints. Such risks and side effects might be tolerable if the procedure is used to alleviate severe disability. But in order for healthy subjects to volunteer themselves for neurosurgery, there would have to be some very substantial enhancement of normal functionality to be gained. This brings us to the second reason to doubt that superintelligence will be achieved through cyborgization, namely that enhancement is likely to be far more difficult than therapy. Patients who suffer from paralysis might benefit from an implant that replaces their severed nerves or activates spinal motion pattern generators. Patients who are deaf or blind might benefit from artificial cochlea and retinas. Patients with Parkinson's disease or chronic pain might benefit from deep brain stimulation that excites or inhibits activity in a particular area of the brain. What seems far more difficult to achieve is a high-bandwidth direct interaction between brain and computer to provide substantial increases in intelligence of a form that could not be more readily attained by other means. Most of the potential benefits that brain implants could provide in healthy subjects could be obtained at far less risk, expense, and inconvenience by using our regular motor and sensory organs to interact with computers located outside of our bodies. We do not need to plug a fiber optic cable into our brains in order to access the internet. Not only can the human retina transmit data at an impressive rate of nearly 10 million bits per second, but it comes pre-packaged with a massive amount of dedicated wetware, the visual cortex, that is highly adapted to extracting meaning from this information torrent and to interfacing with other brain areas for further processing. Even if there were an easy way of pumping more information into our brains, the extra data inflow would do little to increase the rate at which we think and learn, unless all the neural machinery necessary for making sense of the data were similarly upgraded. Since this includes almost all of the brain, what would really be needed is a whole brain prosthesis, which is just another way of saying artificial general intelligence. Yet if one had a human-level AI, one could dispense with neurosurgery. A computer might as well have a metal casting as one a bone. So this limiting case just takes us back to the AI path, which we have already examined. Brain-computer interfacing has also been proposed as a way to get information out of the brain for purposes of communicating with other brains or with machines. Such uplinks have helped patients with locked-in syndrome to communicate with the outside world by enabling them to move a cursor on a screen by thought. The bandwidth attained in such experiments is low. The patient painstakingly types out one slow letter after another at a rate of a few words per minute. One can readily imagine improved versions of this technology. Perhaps a next-generation implant could plug into Broca's area, a region in the frontal lobe involved in language production, and pick up internal speech. But while such a technology might assist some people with disabilities induced by stroke or muscular degeneration, it would hold little appeal for healthy subjects. The functionality it would provide is essentially that of a microphone, coupled with speech recognition software, which is already commercially available, minus the pain, inconvenience, expense, and risks associated with neurosurgery, and minus at least some of the hyper-Orwellian overtones of an intracranial listening device. Keeping our machines outside of our bodies also makes upgrading easier. But what about the dream of bypassing words altogether and establishing a connection between two brains that enables concepts, thoughts, or entire areas of expertise to be downloaded from one mind to another? We can download large files to our computers, including libraries with millions of books and articles, and this can be done over the course of seconds. Could something similar be done with our brains? The apparent plausibility of this idea probably derives from an incorrect view of how information is stored and represented in the brain. As noted, the rate-limiting step in human intelligence is not how fast raw data can be fed into the brain, but rather how quickly the brain can extract meaning and make sense of the data. Perhaps it will be suggested that we transmit meanings directly, rather than package them into sensory data that must be decoded by the recipient. There are two problems with this. The first is that brains, by contrast to the kinds of program we typically run on our computers, do not use standardized data storage and representation formats. Rather, each brain develops its own idiosyncratic representations of higher-level content. Which particular neuronal assemblies are recruited to represent a particular concept depends on the unique experiences of the brain in question, along with various genetic factors and stochastic physiological processes. Just as in artificial neural nets, meaning in biological neural networks is likely represented holistically in the structure and activity patterns of sizable overlapping regions, not in discrete memory cells laid out in neat arrays. It would therefore not be possible to establish a simple mapping between the neurons in one brain and those in another, in such a way that thoughts could automatically slide over from one to the other. In order for the thoughts of one brain to be intelligible to another, the thoughts need to be decomposed and packaged into symbols according to some shared convention that allows the symbols to be correctly interpreted by the receiving brain. This is the job of language. In principle, one could imagine offloading the cognitive work of articulation and interpretation to an interface that would somehow read out the neural states in the sender's brain and somehow feed in a bespoke pattern of activation to the receiver's brain. But this brings us to the second problem with the cyborg scenario. Even setting aside the quite immense technical challenge of how to reliably read and write simultaneously from perhaps billions of individually addressable neurons, creating the requisite interface is probably an AI-complete problem. The interface would need to include a component able, in real time, to map firing patterns in one brain onto semantically equivalent firing patterns in the other brain. The detailed multi-level understanding of the neural computation needed to accomplish such a task would seem to directly enable neuromorphic AI. Despite these reservations, the cyborg route toward cognitive enhancement is not entirely without promise. Impressive work on the rat hippocampus has demonstrated the feasibility of a neural prosthesis that can enhance performance in a simple working memory task. In its present version, the implant collects input from a dozen or two electrodes located in one area, CA3, of the hippocampus, and projects onto a similar number of neurons in another area, CA1. A microprocessor is trained to discriminate between two different firing patterns in the first area, corresponding to two different memories, right lever or left lever, and to learn how these patterns are projected into the second area. This prosthesis can not only restore function when the normal neural connection between the two neural areas is blockaded, but by sending an especially cleared token of a particular memory pattern to the second area, it can enhance the performance on the memory task beyond what the rat is normally capable of. While a technical tour de force by contemporary standards, the study leaves many challenging questions unanswered. How well does the approach scale to greater numbers of memories? How well can we control the combinatorial explosion that otherwise threatens to make learning the correct mapping infeasible as the number of input and output neurons is increased? Does the enhanced performance on the test task come at some hidden cost, such as reduced ability to generalize from the particular stimulus used in the experiment, or reduced ability to unlearn the association when the environment changes? Would the test subjects still somehow benefit even if, unlike rats, they could avail themselves of external memory aids such as pen and paper? And how much harder would it be to apply a similar method to other parts of the brain? Whereas the present prosthesis takes advantage of the relatively simple feed-forward structure of parts of the hippocampus, basically serving as a unidirectional bridge between areas CA3 and CA1, other structures in the cortex involve convoluted feedback loops, which greatly increase the complexity of the wiring diagram and, presumably, the difficulty of deciphering the functionality of any embedded group of neurons. One hope for the cyborg route is that the brain, if permanently implanted with a device connecting it to some external resource, would over time learn an effective mapping between its own internal cognitive states and the inputs it receives from, or the outputs accepted by, the device. Then, the implant itself would not need to be intelligent. Rather, the brain would intelligently adapt to the interface, much as the brain of an infant gradually learns to interpret the signals arriving from receptors in its eyes and ears. But here again, one must question how much would really be gained. Suppose that the brain's plasticity were such that it could learn to detect patterns in some new input stream, arbitrarily projected onto some part of the cortex by means of a brain-computer interface. Why not project the same information onto the retina instead, as a visual pattern, or onto the cochlea, as sounds? The low-tech alternative avoids 1,000 complications, and in either case, the brain could deploy its pattern recognition mechanisms and plasticity to learn to make sense of the information. Networks and organizations. Another conceivable path to superintelligence is through the gradual enhancement of networks and organizations that link individual human minds with one another and with various artifacts and bots. The idea here is not that this would enhance the intellectual capacity of individuals enough to make them superintelligent, but rather that some system composed of individuals thus networked and organized might attain a form of superintelligence, what in the next chapter we will elaborate as collective superintelligence. Humanity has gained enormously in collective intelligence over the course of history and prehistory. The gains come from many sources, including innovations in communications technology, such as writing and printing, and above all, the introduction of language itself. Increases in the size of the world population and the density of habitation. Various improvements in organizational techniques and epistemic norms. And a gradual accumulation of institutional capital. In general terms, a system's collective intelligence is limited by the abilities of its member minds, the overheads in communicating relevant information between them, and the various distortions and inefficiencies that pervade human organizations. If communication overheads are reduced, including not only equipment costs, but also response latencies, time and attention burdens, and other factors, then larger and more densely connected organizations become feasible. The same could happen if fixes are found for some of the bureaucratic deformations that warp organizational life. Wasteful status games, mission creep, concealment or falsification of information, and other agency problems. Even partial solutions to these problems could pay hefty dividends for collective intelligence. The technological and institutional innovations that could contribute to the growth of our collective intelligence are many and various. For example, subsidized prediction markets might foster truth-seeking norms and improve forecasting on contentious scientific and social issues. Lie detectors, should it prove feasible to make ones that are reliable and easy to use, could reduce the scope for deception in human affairs. Self-deception detectors might be even more powerful. Even without newfangled brain technologies, some forms of deception might become harder to practice, thanks to increased availability of many kinds of data, including reputations and track records, or the promulgation of strong epistemic norms and rationality culture. Voluntary and involuntary surveillance will amass vast amounts of information about human behavior. Social networking sites are already used by over 1 billion people to share personal details. Soon, these people might begin uploading continuous life recordings from microphones and video cameras embedded in their smartphones or eyeglass frames. Automated analysis of such data streams will enable many new applications, sinister as well as benign, of course. Growth in collective intelligence may also come from more general organizational and economic improvements, and from enlarging the fraction of the world's population that is educated, digitally connected, and integrated into global intellectual culture. The Internet stands out as a particularly dynamic frontier for innovation and experimentation. Most of its potential may still remain unexploited. Continuing development of an intelligent web, with better support for deliberation, debiasing and judgment aggregation, might make large contributions to increasing the collective intelligence of humanity as a whole, or of particular groups. But what of the seemingly more fanciful idea that the Internet might one day wake up? Could the Internet become something more than just the backbone of a loosely integrated collective superintelligence? Something more like a virtual skull housing an emerging unified superintellect? This was one of the ways that superintelligence could arise, according to Werner Winger's influential 1993 essay, which coined the term technological singularity. Against this, one could object that machine intelligence is hard enough to achieve through arduous engineering, and that it is incredible to suppose that it will arise spontaneously. However, the story need not be that some future version of the Internet suddenly becomes superintelligent by mere happenstance. A more plausible version of the scenario would be that the Internet accumulates improvements through the work of many people over many years, work to engineer better search and information filtering algorithms, more powerful data representation formats, more capable autonomous software agents, and more efficient protocols governing the interactions between such bots, and that myriad incremental improvements eventually create the basis for some more unified form of web intelligence. It seems at least conceivable that such a web-based cognitive system, supersaturated with computer power and all other resources needed for explosive growth, save for one crucial ingredient, could, when the final missing constituent is dropped into the cauldron, blaze up with superintelligence. This type of scenario, though, converges into another possible path to superintelligence, that of artificial general intelligence, which we have already discussed. Summary. The fact that there are many paths that lead to superintelligence should increase our confidence that we will eventually get there. If one path turns out to be blocked, we can still progress. That there are multiple paths does not entail that there are multiple destinations. Even if significant intelligence amplification were first achieved along one of the non-machine intelligence paths, this would not render machine intelligence irrelevant. Quite the contrary, enhanced biological or organizational intelligence would accelerate scientific and technological developments, potentially hastening the arrival of more radical forms of intelligence amplification, such as whole brain emulation and AI. This is not to say that it is a matter of indifference how we get to machine superintelligence. The path taken to get there could make a big difference to the eventual outcome. Even if the ultimate capabilities that are obtained do not depend much on the trajectory, how those capabilities will be used, how much control we humans have over their disposition, might well depend on details of our approach. For example, enhancements of biological or organizational intelligence might increase our ability to anticipate risk and to design machine superintelligence that is safe and beneficial. A full strategic assessment involves many complexities and will have to await Chapter 14. True superintelligence, as opposed to marginal increases in current levels of intelligence, might plausibly first be attained via the AI path. There are, however, many fundamental uncertainties along this path. This makes it difficult to rigorously assess how long the path is, or how many obstacles there are along the way. The whole brain emulation path also has some chance of being the quickest route to superintelligence. Since progress along this path requires many incremental technological advances, rather than theoretical breakthroughs, a strong case can be made that it will eventually succeed. It seems fairly likely, however, that even if progress along the whole brain emulation path is swift, artificial intelligence will nevertheless be first to cross the finishing line. This is because of the possibility of neuromorphic AIs based on partial emulations. Biological cognitive enhancements are clearly feasible, particularly ones based on genetic selection. Iterated embryo selection currently seems like an especially promising technology. Compared with possible breakthroughs in machine intelligence, however, biological enhancements would be relatively low and gradual. They would at best result in relatively weak forms of superintelligence. More on this shortly. The clear feasibility of biological enhancement should increase our confidence that machine intelligence is ultimately achievable, since enhanced human scientists and engineers will be able to make more and faster progress than their au naturel counterparts. Especially in scenarios in which machine intelligence is delayed beyond mid-century, the increasingly cognitively enhanced cohorts coming on stage will play a growing role in subsequent developments. Brain-computer interfaces look unlikely as a source of superintelligence. Improvements in networks and organizations might result in weakly superintelligent forms of collective intelligence in the long run. But more likely, they will play an enabling role similar to that of biological cognitive enhancement, gradually increasing humanity's effective ability to solve intellectual problems. Compared with biological enhancements, advances in networks and organization will make a difference sooner. In fact, such advances are occurring continuously and are having a significant impact already. However, improvements in networks and organizations may yield narrower increases in our problem-solving capacity than will improvements in biological cognition, boosting collective intelligence rather than quality intelligence, to anticipate a distinction we are about to introduce in the next chapter. Chapter 3: Forms of Superintelligence. So what exactly do we mean by superintelligence? While we do not wish to get bogged down in terminological swamps, something needs to be said to clarify the conceptual ground. This chapter identifies three different forms of superintelligence, and argues that they are, in a practically relevant sense, equivalent. We also show that the potential for intelligence in a machine substrate is vastly greater than in a biological substrate. Machines have a number of fundamental advantages which will give them overwhelming superiority. Biological humans, even if enhanced, will be outclassed. Many machines and non-human animals already perform at superhuman levels in narrow domains. Bats interpret sonar signals better than man. Calculators outperform us in arithmetic, and chess programs beat us in chess. The range of specific tasks that can be better performed by software will continue to expand. But although specialized information processing systems will have many uses, there are additional profound issues that arise only with the prospect of machine intellects that have enough general intelligence to substitute for humans across the board. As previously indicated, we use the term superintelligence to refer to intellects that greatly outperform the best current human minds across many very general cognitive domains. This is still quite vague. Different kinds of system with rather disparate performance attributes could qualify as superintelligences under this definition. To advance the analysis, it is helpful to disaggregate this simple notion of superintelligence by distinguishing different bundles of intellectual supercapabilities. There are many ways in which such decomposition could be done. Here we will differentiate between three forms: speed superintelligence, collective superintelligence, and quality superintelligence. Speed superintelligence. A speed superintelligence is an intellect that is just like a human mind, but faster. This is conceptually the easiest form of superintelligence to analyze. We can define speed superintelligence as follows. Speed superintelligence, a system that can do all that a human intellect can do, but much faster. By much, we here mean something like multiple orders of magnitude. But rather than try to expunge every remnant of vagueness from the definition, we will entrust the reader with interpreting it sensibly. The simplest example of speed superintelligence would be a whole brain emulation running on fast hardware. an emulation operating at a speed of 10,000 times that of a biological brain would be able to read a book in a few seconds and write a PhD thesis in an afternoon. With a speed-up factor of a million, an emulation could accomplish an entire millennium of intellectual work in one working day. To such a fast mind, events in the external world appear to unfold in slow motion. Suppose your mind ran at 10,000 times. If your fleshly friend should happen to drop his teacup, you could watch the porcelain slowly descend toward the carpet over the course of several hours, like a comet silently gliding through space toward an assignation with a far-off planet. And, as the anticipation of the coming crash tardily propagates through the folds of your friend's gray matter, and from thence out into his peripheral nervous system, you could observe his body gradually assuming the aspect of a frozen oops. Enough time for you not only to order a replacement cup, but also to read a couple of scientific papers and take a nap. Because of this apparent time dilation of the material world, a speed superintelligence would prefer to work with digital objects. It could live in virtual reality and deal in the information economy. Alternatively, it could interact with the physical environment by means of nanoscale manipulators, since limbs at such small scales could operate faster than macroscopic appendages. The characteristic frequency of a system tends to be inversely proportional to its length scale. A fast mind might commune mainly with other fast minds, rather than with braditellic, molasses-like humans. The speed of light becomes an increasingly important constraint as minds get faster, since faster minds face greater opportunity costs in the use of their time for traveling or communicating over long distances. Light is roughly a million times faster than a jet plane, so it would take a digital agent with a mental speed-up of 1 million times about the same amount of subjective time to travel across the globe as it does a contemporary human journeyer. Dialing somebody long distance would take as long as getting there in person, though it would be cheaper as a call would require less bandwidth. Agents with large mental speed-ups who want to converse extensively might find it advantageous to move near one another. Extremely fast minds with need for frequent interaction, such as members of a work team, may take up residence in computers located in the same building to avoid frustrating latencies. Collective superintelligence. Another form of superintelligence is a system achieving superior performance by aggregating large numbers of smaller intelligences. Collective superintelligence. A system composed of a large number of smaller intellects, such that the system's overall performance across many very general domains vastly outstrips that of any current cognitive system. Collective superintelligence is less conceptually clear-cut than speed superintelligence. However, it is more familiar empirically. While we have no experience with human-level minds that differ significantly in clock speed, we do have ample experience with collective intelligence, systems composed of various numbers of human-level components working together with various degrees of efficiency. Firms, work teams, gossip networks, advocacy groups, academic communities, countries, even humankind as a whole can, if we adopt a somewhat abstract perspective, be viewed as loosely defined systems capable of solving classes of intellectual problems. From experience, we have some sense of how easily different tasks succumb to the efforts of organizations of various size and composition. Collective intelligence excels at solving problems that can be readily broken into parts, such that solutions to subproblems can be pursued in parallel and verified independently. Tasks like building a space shuttle or operating a hamburger franchise offer myriad opportunities for division of labor. Different engineers work on different components of the spacecraft. Different staffs operate different restaurants. In academia, the rigid division of researchers, students, journals, grants, and prizes into separate self-contained disciplines, though unconducive to the type of work represented by this book, might, only in a conciliatory and mellow frame of mind, be viewed as a necessary accommodation to the practicalities of allowing large numbers of diversely motivated individuals and teams to contribute to the growth of human knowledge while working relatively independently, each ploughing their own furrow. A system's collective intelligence could be enhanced by expanding the number or the quality of its constituent intellects, or by improving the quality of their organization. To obtain a collective superintelligence from any present-day collective intelligence would require a very great degree of enhancement. The resulting system would need to be capable of vastly outperforming any current collective intelligence or other cognitive system across many very general domains. A new conference format that lets scholars exchange information more effectively, or a new collaborative information filtering algorithm that better predicted users' ratings of books and movies, would clearly not on its own amount to anything approaching collective superintelligence. Nor would a 50% increase in the world population, or an improvement in pedagogical method that enabled students to complete a school day in 4 hours instead of 6. Some far more extreme growth of humanity's collective cognitive capacity would be required to meet the criterion of collective superintelligence. Note that the threshold for collective superintelligence is indexed to the performance levels of the present, that is, the early 21st century. Over the course of human prehistory, and again over the course of human history, humanity's collective intelligence has grown by very large factors. World population, for example, has increased by at least a factor of 1,000 since the Pleistocene. On this basis alone, current levels of human collective intelligence could be regarded as approaching superintelligence relative to a Pleistocene baseline. Some improvements in communications technologies, especially spoken language, but perhaps also cities, writing and printing, could also be argued to have individually or in combination provided supersized boosts in the sense that if another innovation of comparable impact to our collective intellectual problem-solving capacity were to happen, it would result in collective superintelligence. A certain kind of reader will be tempted at this point to interject that modern society does not seem so particularly intelligent. Perhaps some unwelcome political decision has just been made in the reader's home country, and the apparent unwisdom of that decision now looms large in the reader's mind as evidence of the mental incapacity of the modern era. And is it not the case that contemporary humanity is idolizing material consumption, depleting natural resources, polluting the environment, decimating species diversity, all the while failing to remedy screaming global injustices and neglecting paramount humanistic or spiritual values? However, setting aside the question of how modernity's shortcomings stack up against the not-so-inconsiderable failings of earlier epochs, nothing in our definition of collective superintelligence implies that a society with greater collective intelligence is necessarily better off. The definition does not even imply that the more collectively intelligent society is wiser. We can think of wisdom as the ability to get the important things approximately right. It is then possible to imagine an organization composed of a very large cadre of very efficiently coordinated knowledge workers who, collectively, can solve intellectual problems across many very general domains. This organization, let us suppose, can operate most kinds of businesses, invent most kinds of technologies, and optimize most kinds of processes. Even so, it might get a few key big-picture issues entirely wrong. For instance, it may fail to take proper precautions against existential risks, and as a result, pursue a short explosive growth spurt that ends ingloriously in total collapse. Such an organization could have a very high degree of collective intelligence. If sufficiently high, the organization is a collective superintelligence. We should resist the temptation to roll every normatively desirable attribute into one giant amorphous concept of mental functioning, as though one could never find one admirable trait without all the others being equally present. Instead, we should recognize that there can exist instrumentally powerful information processing systems, intelligence systems, that are neither inherently good nor reliably wise. But we will revisit this issue in Chapter 7. Collective superintelligence could be either loosely or tightly integrated.